4. The new kid in town. Sweat. The prevailing sensory memory of my early acting career is of the smell, sight, and feel of my adult colleagues' on-set perspiration. Jesus, what a sweaty business it was. With Gig Young, it was boozy sweat, the smell of alcohol seeping through his pores. This was in an episode from the first season of The Twilight Zone that is now regarded as one of the show's best, Walking Distance. Young played a cynical, big-city advertising guy named Martin Sloan, whose car breaks down just outside of the town where he grew up. To kill time, he strolls through his old stomping grounds, only to discover that he has been transported back to his town at the time of his childhood. Sloan freaks out when he recognizes that he is an adult from the future, witnessing the comings and goings of his younger self and his parents, long dead, but suddenly alive again and in their prime. I played Martin Sloan's little brother, who offers the first tell that things are amiss. When Gig sits down next to me on the curb and identifies himself as Martin Sloan, I get upset, protest, "You're not Marty Sloan!" and run into the house. It was mainly a fun day's work for me. We shot it on the MGM backlot in Culver City, where I happily discovered a full-scale park with a real jungle gym and merry-go-round. I couldn't define Gig's smell. I clocked its pungency and noticed that he was perspiring so much that his makeup was dripping down onto his collar, which they kept having to touch up. Young was a good actor who inhabited his role perfectly, but I could sense in some intuitive way that this was a man who had some troubles. His unchecked alcoholism later caused his career to unravel. Johnny Cash sweated like crazy, too. I worked with him in a low-budget crime potboiler called 5 Minutes to Live, in which his character, a hard-bitten criminal, hauls me up like a sack of potatoes and takes me hostage. Cash's perspiration was different from Gig Young's. He was nervous about acting, awkward and confused about what to do. Johnny's runoff sweat absolutely soaked me as we did take after take. In retrospect, I can diagnose this as a serious case of flop sweat. The producers were trying to capitalize on the fame of Johnny Cash, the music star. But Johnny Cash, the actor, was out of his element. Between takes, he was gentle and soft-spoken, a kind man who made a point of showing me that the gun he was holding had a metal block in its muzzle that prevented it from firing bullets. Again, I loved being in on the magic trick. But it was strange to be in on something else. Adult fallibility. I wouldn't have called it that then, but I recognized on some level that I was more comfortable on a soundstage than Johnny Cash was. The sweatiest picture I ever worked on was The Music Man, which came a little later. I played Winthrop Peru, the little brother of Shirley Jones's Marion the Librarian. I still have visions of the rivulets of sweat streaking down Shirley's and Robert Preston's faces, smearing the heavy makeup they wore. They shot The Music Man in Technicolor. To get that rich, saturated look in the early 60s, they had to blast the set with bright light, on average about 250 foot candles worth. A foot candle is an antique unit of illumination that gets its name from the theater, where in the days before electricity, actual candles were used as footlights. You don't even hear about foot candles anymore in the movie-making business, but even for the era, 250 was a high number. A decade later, when I shot American Graffiti with George Lucas, which takes place mostly at night, George made waves by shooting at only 8 foot candles, and even 4 in some shots. When we did close-ups in The Music Man, the lighting went from 250 to a ridiculous 500 foot candles. That's actually how I knew when I was on my mark, when I could feel an abrupt temperature shift from hot to unbearably hot. If you look at any close-up in The Music Man in high definition, you can actually see the sweat beating above the actor's lips. You know who barely broke a sweat? Me. In those early days, performing came pretty easily to me. So much of the work seemed like play. They used me a lot on the sitcom The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. a show that I enjoyed watching at home, even though its high school plot lines were mostly lost on me. My little boy character was always returning pop bottles to Dobie's father's grocery store for a 5-cent deposit, an action that, and man, this blew my mind, you could actually carry out in real life. Thanks to Dobie Gillis, I became serious about collecting and returning bottles for a while. I stashed my booty of nickels in an old cigar box from Aunt Julia's hotel, which I had covered with stickers from our travels to Venice, Paris, and London after the journey. Beyond that, it was simply cool to be in the presence of Dwayne Hickman and Bob Denver, who played respectively Dobie and his beatnik sidekick, Maynard G. Krebs. Bob later starred as Gilligan on Gilligan's Island. I was a genuine fan of theirs, and the vibe on that set was upbeat. When Dad got a call for me to be on that show, I went happily. Dennis the Menace was different. My job as a member of Dennis's troupe of pals was not demanding, but I was bummed on behalf of Jay North, who played Dennis. He was 3 years older than me, a seasoned vet in my eyes, but I could tell he was tired. They really ran him ragged. I came to recognize when I got the Andy Griffith Show that it was lucky for me that Opie was a supporting character. He had some choice scenes in most of the episodes, but he never had to carry the show. Jay did. He couldn't hang out with us between scenes. That was the big thing. For me, it was always a breeze to shoot an episode of TV with other kids involved, whether it was Dennis the Menace or Andy Griffith, because you could talk and play with him when you weren't shooting. Poor Jay had to sit by himself under one of those 1950s beehive bonnet hair dryers that you saw in ladies' salons, forbidden from moving, all for his trademark hairdo. Jay needed to have the same pointy cowlick on the back of his head that the cartoon Dennis wore in the Hank Ketchum comic strip. A weird-looking thing Jay's cowlick was, like the stem of a pumpkin made out of blonde hair. Whenever the director yelled cut and we went on break, a small team of people surrounded Jay, spritzing the cowlick with hairspray and covering it up in a wire mesh net, cowlick scaffolding, basically, before sitting him under the dryer. While the rest of us kids were making paper airplanes and holding contests to see whose would fly the farthest, Jay was stuck in his chair, immobile, in the service of this stupid hairstyle. A couple of years later, when I worked on the Andy Griffith Show, I watched Dennis the Menace with my father, and we both noticed that they had done away with Dennis's cowlick. I felt relieved for Jay. Dad and I sat there, commenting, like the pair of industry professionals that we were, about the producer's choice. "Dad, they're not doing the hair thing to Jay anymore." "No, I think it was too hard, too much of a nuisance. Good decision." "Yeah, good move, losing the cowlick." It wasn't long before we had a third Howard dude in the house pitching in his 2 cents. I awoke in the morning of April 20th, 1959, to discover my maternal grandparents, Butch and Louise, in our apartment. They traveled west to help out with the childcare while Mom and Dad acclimated to a two-child household. Later that day, the phone rang, and Grandma, still holding the receiver in her hand, announced, "You've got a brother, and his name is Clint." It felt like Christmas morning. My protege, comrade, and future playmate had arrived. My mother needed some time to recuperate at St. Joseph Hospital in Burbank, so I did not meet Clinton Ingle Howard, to use his full name, until a few days after his birth, when Mom was discharged. I had an audition for one of the CBS shows that day, so my father drove me straight from Television City to the hospital, where we collected Mom and Clint in the Plymouth Cranbrook and brought them home. With no children's car seats back then, Clint rode home cradled in my grandmother's arms in the back seat. I sat next to her, looking on in awe at this little blonde-haired baby. Like Mark, the brother I sadly never knew, Clint had the same circular face and high forehead as our granddad Butch. The birth announcement my parents sent out for Clint a couple of weeks later included a little drawing of a blonde baby in a safety pin diaper and boxing gloves with the words, "We've got a new lightweight champ. He's a knockout." Ahead of Clint's birth, we had moved into a larger apartment directly across Cordova Street from our first one, the bottom half of a nice little two-unit house with a Spanish-tiled roof. Dad got the landlord to knock $10 off the monthly rent in exchange for maintaining the lawn. I doted on baby Clint, holding him in my lap with a baby blanket draped over my dungarees to protect me in case his diaper leaked. Mom didn't nurse, so I bottle-fed Clint his formula, which I considered a big brother privilege. There wasn't much else I could do yet with my brother, but one benefit of his arrival was that I really got to know my grandparents for the first time, particularly Grandma Louise. She and I were the early risers in the house, me in my pajamas, Grandma in her house coat with her thin, wispy hair showing because she hadn't yet put on her wig. The Spiegel side of the family was always sort of physically falling apart. They were fun and high-spirited people, but they made no effort to look after themselves. My grandparents and mother all smoked heavily. Butch was an alcoholic, albeit, thankfully, a non-aggressive one. As for Mom, she already had a mouthful of false teeth by the time that Clint and I came along. In the kitchen, Grandma Louise would put the coffee on and tell me stories of growing up in Oklahoma in the olden days. The first automobile in Duncan, she said, was owned by a Cherokee chief who had struck it rich when oil was discovered beneath his land. He often rode into town with 7 or 8 men hanging from his car. Louise had light blonde hair as a small child. One day, when she was 4, the Cherokees, fascinated by her coloring, scooped her up and drove her back to the reservation. She felt no fear, she told me, and actually had a good time playing with the Cherokee kids. But the townspeople of Duncan were alarmed, and the men formed a posse, riding out to the reservation on horseback with their rifles and shotguns, ready for a confrontation. Fortunately, the matter was resolved peacefully. The Cherokee chief explained that they meant no harm, and my grandmother was reunited with her family. My father, being both thrifty and handy, decided to build a playmat for Clint, today they're called baby gyms, rather than buy one from the store. He sanded down a big wooden board and attached fun things to it, a steering wheel, a light switch, various knobs, all the good stuff that will keep a baby occupied and out of trouble. I so admired Dad's handiwork that I ended up using the playmat as much as Clint did. Clint was physically precocious, more so than I had been, and was walking not long after his first birthday. One day, I was deep in concentration, fidgeting with the switches and knobs on the board, when I felt a warm stream of liquid hitting my arm. I turned around, and Clint stood there in a t-shirt but no diaper, arms straight out, pelvis thrust forward, peeing on me. Catching my eye, he threw his head back and laughed an evil little laugh, saying, "Hee-hee-hee-hee-hee-hee." I was furious. I went to Dad and reported Clint's misdeed, pleading, "You should spank him." Spanking happened in our house. Nothing bad, just 3 quick swats of the butt. Whack, whack, whack. The spanking stung me emotionally more than physically, and they always scared me straight. But Dad said it would be wrong to spank Clint. "When I give you a spanking, I know that you understand what you did," he said. "Clint's too young to understand. He doesn't know, so he won't get spanked. I'm sorry that he peed on you. Now go get yourself washed up." By the time I took a bath and returned to the living room, my mood had changed. Clint, with his squinty eyes and teeth coming in unevenly, was still doing that laugh. Hee-hee-hee-hee-hee-hee-hee. And I had to admit, the sight of him was pretty hilarious. I cracked up and thereafter started calling Clint the hee-hee man. It's been one of my nicknames for him ever since.
The hee-hee man incident, of which I have no memory, is so representative of who we were and still are. Ron, the kid always on the straight and narrow, and me, the mischievous little guy toting the squirt gun, forever trying to see what he can get away with. The 5-year difference between us meant that I benefited from Ron's experience and even-keeled nature, while Ron enjoyed the go-for-broke spirit with which I embrace life. Later on, when he first attempted to make short films with an 8mm camera, he cast me as his leading man, knowing that I was willing to do and try anything. Ron and I were never in competition, as siblings so often are. I looked up to him. Coming along second gave me a great vantage point from which to watch and learn. I observed and took mental notes as Ron navigated tricky waters as a juvenile actor, a schoolboy, and as a child of Rance and Gene Howard, who were way more protective of him than they were of me. A classic second child scenario. In personality, I was more like Mom, who had the gift of gab. She could make friends in an elevator in two floors. But I worshiped my dad. He was my teacher, my guide, and my moral compass. In fact, my first clear memory of him is one of those classic Rance Howard teachable moments. I observed as he took apart an old shed with a crowbar. All was going well until he reared back too fast with the crowbar, and the damn thing struck him right in the kisser. Suddenly, blood was streaming out of his mouth, along with a string of words I had never heard before. Shit, fuck, goddamn. And who could blame him? He was an actor who had just messed up his face. But then he remembered that his toddler son was sitting right there on the grass, witnessing his cuss fest. Dad checked himself. Wiping his mouth with a rag, he calmly explained what each of these words meant, and correspondingly, why I should never, ever say them. As Ron mentioned, I also took after Butch. I was his spitting image, though I didn't get to know him. He died only a year after I was born, at the too young age of 56. His drinking, smoking, and insistence that all foods must necessarily be deep-fried and smothered with gravy caught up with him fast. When my Spiegel grandparents came out to help when I was born, Dad and Butch drove to the supermarket for groceries. Butch was on his best behavior, under orders from Louise not to drink in the Howard house. But when they reached the grocery store, Butch asked Dad to buy him a pint flask of vodka. Dad obliged. And it was the damnedest thing, Dad told me. He opened the flask right there in the parking lot and drank it down in three swigs. It turns out that I had more in common with Butch than just looks.
With two little mouths to feed, Dad couldn't afford to get complacent about his craft. He took an acting workshop with a man named Sherman Marks, who also happened to be a television director. While Mom looked after Clint, Dad invited me to tag along and observe. Evidently, Sherman Marks was also observing me. When he got a job in 1959 to direct a pilot for an NBC comedy series, he asked for Dad's permission to have me audition for it. Mr. O'Malley was based on a 1940s comic strip called Barnaby by Crockett Johnson, creator of Harold and the Purple Crayon. Barnaby was a 5-year-old boy who, in a subversive inversion of traditional children's stories, had not a fairy godmother, but a fairy godfather. This fairy godfather, Mr. O'Malley, was a cantankerous little man who wore a pork pie hat, smoked cigars, and was borne aloft, just barely, by a set of 4 dinky little wings. A little bit like Clarence the Angel in It's a Wonderful Life, but more gruff. Barnaby was the only person who could actually see and speak with Mr. O'Malley, whose alleged existence exasperated Barnaby's parents. They took their son to a series of child psychologists to dissuade him of his delusions. I passed the audition and got the role as Barnaby. On paper, it sounds like a difficult concept for a 5-year-old actor to grasp, a boy with an imaginary friend and parents who disbelieve him. But Dad broke things down for me, walking me through the character's logic. With Gig Young in The Twilight Zone, I didn't understand that I was participating in a parable about a hardened city slicker who had lost touch with his hometown values. Dad just said, "You have no idea what this man is talking about, and you think he's crazy." That was all I needed to know. In Mr. O'Malley, Dad said, "Barnaby believes Mr. O'Malley is real and should be treated as such. When his parents say there's no such thing as a fairy godfather, well, Barnaby's parents are just wrong." I didn't think of the Mr. O'Malley job as any kind of big deal until I learned that the actor playing Mr. O'Malley was the man who played the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, Burt Lahr. This was a big whoa. In person, Lahr was simultaneously bigger than life and kind of a disappointment. He had a huge bulbous nose and a commanding presence, but no particular affinity for his co-star, me. He wasn't rude, just transactional, exuding no warmth. And he seemed impossibly old, though I just looked up the dates and guess what? He was slightly younger than I am now. Once again, I was working opposite a profuse perspirer. Burt Lahr sweated like a faucet was on. His sweat smelled like the cigarettes that he chain-smoked. Curiously enough, he couldn't stand cigars, so the prop department rigged up a fake cigar that could fit a cigarette inside it for Mr. O'Malley. God, the secondhand smoke that I inhaled as a kid between Lahr, my mom, my grandparents, and the Andy Griffith cast and crew, it's a wonder that I don't have severe lung issues. What made up for the Cowardly Lion's indifference was O'Malley's invisible sidekick, a leprechaun named McSnoid, played by Mel Blanc, the voice of Bugs Bunny, Donald Duck, Porky Pig, Sylvester the Cat, Tweety Bird, Foghorn Leghorn, and Elmer Fudd. When Dad told me who the balding man with the mustache was, I zoomed up to him, eager to shake his hand. Blank was clearly used to awestruck kids like me and obligingly performed a highlight reel of his characters, saliva flying everywhere as I delighted in his repertoire. And to Lahr's credit, he was amazing once the cameras were rolling. He provided my first exposure to an entertainer for whom the command action is like the flick of a switch. He rose to the occasion and transformed into the character, bringing a completely different energy to his performance than he did to his off-camera interactions with the cast and crew. Mr. O'Malley was good television, and I felt like I was a part of something special. Right before my eyes was a sight that I, at least, found entertaining and hilarious. Lahr floating into frame with little pink wings on his back and Blank off to the side bringing his voice wizardry to the leprechaun character. What I didn't yet understand was the relationship between the scenes that we were shooting beneath those hot lights and a living, breathing audience of viewers. I made no connection between my own passionate viewing of Superman, the Lone Ranger, Popeye, the Heckle and Jekyll cartoons, and Laurel and Hardy comedy shorts, and the work that I was doing. As for prime time, it was past my bedtime. I didn't see myself on TV until the Andy Griffith Show, which my parents occasionally allowed me to stay up and watch on Monday nights. I was not aware that the camera was a portal and that people outside the studio were actually watching my performances until I started hearing shouts of, "Hey, Opie," when I walked down the street. The Mr. O'Malley pilot got its shot at winning over America when it aired one evening on General Electric Theater, yet another popular anthology TV series of the era. The program's host was a former movie star who was now in a career doldrum, reduced to being a television presenter. Give the guy credit, though. He liked what he saw in me. At the broadcast conclusion, Ronald Reagan ad-libbed the line, and special thanks to little Ronnie Howard, who did a wonderful job as Barnaby. My performance also caught the eye of a major TV producer named Sheldon Leonard, the co-creator of the long-running hit sitcom The Danny Thomas Show. Leonard's great gift was tailoring a TV show to a specific actor's skill set. For Thomas, a successful nightclub comedian, he created a series in which Thomas played a family man who was also a successful nightclub comedian. Leonard also helped Carl Reiner mold The Dick Van Dyke Show, so that it played to Van Dyke's strengths as an expressive actor with an elastic face and physical comedy chops. When Leonard saw me play Barnaby, he was building yet another program around a seasoned actor-comedian, in this case, a folksy guy from North Carolina named Andy Griffith.